underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. If you knew the date of your death, how would you live your life? It is the question at the center of Chloe Benjamin's new novel, The Immortalists. It's 1969 in New York City's Lower East Side, and word has spread of the arrival of a traveling psychic who claims to be able to tell anyone the day they will die. In search of one thing they can know for sure, the Gold Children sneak out to hear their fortunes. Though the siblings keep the date secret from one another, their prophecies inform their next 5 decades. Chloe Benjamin is the author of the novel The Anatomy of Dreams. Again, the new novel is The Immortalists. And it's a pleasure to welcome Chloe Benjamin to this week's book show. Chloe, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is such an honor.
What brought you to this idea? What planted that seed?
I always say I wish I had a good fortune teller story of my own, but it really comes out of my own neuroses. I am somebody who's always struggled with uncertainty, and I use knowledge as a way to ground myself when I'm faced with uncertainty, but I'm also aware that knowledge can be a double-edged sword and that it's not always helpful. So for me, the book is about that question of the unknown, which is so core to human life and perhaps no more relevant than regarding mortality.
Do you find that people take the premise differently in the sense of that older people may take it differently than younger people, and that it sort of depends on how you're brought up, of as you said, of whether you have those uncertainties or not?
I do think that's true. I also think the difference that I see is in how they would answer this question of, if you knew the date of your death, how would you live your life, and would you want to know the date of your death? I find that people who are older and a lot of people who are parents would like to know their date if they could, because they could plan for their children, or if they are, you know, retired, they could sort of think about how much time they have left. I think people of that age are already aware of their mortality in a way that younger people aren't, so maybe it's not quite as terrifying. Whereas I think that young people and people who haven't had children yet are like, don't tell me, I don't want to know.
One of the things that's fascinating about the novel is, of course, that question is central, but as you bring up in the novel, do the children really know when they'll die, or do they simply believe that they know? And how do these expectations and fate and chance all interact to influence the course of their life?
Right, exactly. I've had people ask me, you know, was this woman right? Did she truly have psychic powers, or was it, you know, did what happens in the novel come down to self-fulfilling prophecies in certain cases? And I actually don't know myself. I think if I had a firm idea one way or the other, I wouldn't have been able to write the novel with an openness to a few different possibilities. So for me, it's always an both and that's where the interest lies. So I'm as interested as anybody else in sort of debating it with readers.
So let's talk about some of the characters, and let's begin with Simon, the youngest child. This is set in the 70s and 80s in San Francisco. What brought you to that time and place for Simon?
Well, I grew up in San Francisco, not during the time that that the book is set. I was born a little bit later in the 80s, but I've always been incredibly passionate about the city and about its history of gay rights, in part because I grew up with two sets of parents, one of whom was gay and one of whom was straight. So I think having that family background has made me really really passionate, like I said, about the gay community and what they've been through. So even though I'm not a gay man and I wasn't alive at that time, I felt really strongly about portraying it and hopefully doing so with integrity, since it wasn't my personal experience.
Clara is the next youngest child and always had this interest in magic. And does that then correlate to wanting to go to the fortune teller in the first place?
Yeah, I think she's open from the beginning. Some of the siblings are, you know, less keen than others on going to see her. But Clara's always been fascinated by magic, even as a small child, and that carries into her adulthood when she becomes a traveling magician. So I do think that right off the bat, she has more of a curiosity about what's typically thought of as not possible or not real, and an interest in walking between those two worlds.
And it is obviously a strange profession for someone to do. And what kind of research went into, okay, what does a traveling magician do?
Well, I did a lot of research for each section in the book, and that one was no different. The research for Clara's section was a lot of fun, actually. I didn't know much about the world of magic before I wrote the book. And so I started by learning my magical history, so to speak. I read a book that was profoundly helpful called Hiding the Elephant by Jim Steinmeier, who is a wonderful historian of magicians and magic tricks through the past few hundred years. And what he really illuminates is not just the most famous tricks and how they were done, but the interpersonal components, the rivalries between magicians, what brought these people to the world of magic in the first place. And then from there, I could branch off into learning about the role of women in magic, which has always been pretty maligned, the kinds of tricks that Clara might have wanted to do and how she does them, what sorts of organizations and opportunities exist for magicians today, or in Clara's case, in the 90s when her section takes place. So it was really enlightening and a lot of fun.
The other thing, too, is that she sees magic as a way not to deceive people, but to allow them to go deeper, allow them to find those mysterious dimensions of our human experience, and also that how magic adds to reality. Is that something that you wanted to explore, not just with this character, but really with the subject as a whole?
Absolutely, and I think you put it really well. I've always seen Clara as somebody who does not think that magic is a cheap trick, but as you say, that it uncovers the strangeness and the possibility inherent in real life. And she thinks that maybe life is less real or less rigid than we give it credit for. And I think throughout the book, I'm trying to play with this idea of the magic that is inherent in everyday life, whether that is through coincidence or things that can't be explained or religious faith or love. I think there are a lot of places in life as it is where you see the intersection of what can be known and what can't. And to me, that is the definition of magic.
We then move on to Daniel, who is the second oldest child. He becomes a doctor for the U.S. military, the job being to decide whether recruits are healthy enough ultimately to go to war. Obviously, this is a good position, and he is a very smart man, and yet he isn't fully comfortable, is he, with all of that power that he has?
Yeah, I think Daniel is really racked by discomfort and by guilt. He is somebody who looks back at his family's history and feels a lot of shame and a lot of responsibility. And I think as the war in Iraq moves forward, he feels the same thing in his job. His section takes place in 2006, and they're starting to relax regulations as far as who can enter the military. And he's looking at some of the actions of the government and feeling a new sense of uncertainty about his role and the ethics of it. So I always have seen Daniel's section as being about what happens when somebody who feels that they have been wronged in some way does wrong to others. And I think he slowly becomes more and more unhinged as he finds a way to blame somebody else and offload those feelings of guilt.
When you say unhinged, for this character, it is ultimately that he loses empathy. That capacity for empathy is pretty much shot.
Yes, I think that's such a perfect way to put it. And I think that his section is the saddest to me in some ways, because think that happens so often. I think we see it happening right now in this country. It's so easy to say, I'm not the problem, you're the problem. I have no culpability in this. And the more he blames somebody else, the more he's able to forgive himself. But the side effect of that, as you point out, is a lack of compassion that I think is really dangerous.
And as you also say, and yes, it could be the saddest part of the book, because he doesn't realize, obviously, that he's xenophobic. He doesn't realize that he's being sexist.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I try to be really aware of the way that he views this woman and the way that the book, you know, hopefully gives her time to tell her own story. The fortune teller in the novel is part of an ethnic group called the Romani, who have told fortunes for centuries and experienced a lot of discrimination and prejudice as they've moved through the world in search of a home. And throughout the book, she's both revered and reviled for this gift that she has. And I think that you see that particularly in Daniel's attitude toward her.
Chloe Benjamin is our guest. The new novel is The Immortalists. It is published by Putnam. Let us look at the oldest child, who is Varya, becomes a biologist. What is it? And again, these are successful positions, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And she is looking at this idea of extending human lifespan. She is in longevity research, which is, as you can imagine, quite a growing field right now as we become more fixated on how to preserve our youth and forestall death. And like Daniel, she's experienced a great deal of success, but she's also living a very rigid life. So even though she is given a date of death that is supposedly very far out, she responds to that in kind of an inverse way.
And that is one of the fascinating elements of the novel, because she is looking at caloric restriction. She's ultimately looking at this in primates and to see how it extends a lifespan. And yet she knows her expiration date, or has that expiration date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I found so interesting about this research, which is in fact based on actual research and a primate study, is this question of living longer or living more fully. And so I think that you see her process those questions. And in some ways, she's the sibling who undergoes the most change, or the fullest arc.
Let us talk about the parents of these children, Gertie and Saul. They set the baseline, right? They set a lot of the baseline for these children, and obviously they help form their backbone as their moral center, their compass, and yet there are these outside influences. Talk a little bit about Gertie and Saul.
Yeah, Gertie and Saul are the children of immigrants. Their parents came from Eastern Europe, and they were Jews who were escaping the pogroms. And so, like a lot of children of immigrants, they feel both an intense responsibility to live up to their parents' expectations and also a desire for their own personhood. I think we see that in Gertie probably more than Saul. Saul is a more conservative, dutiful person, and Gertie is somebody who in some ways is very much of her time. She, you know, becomes a wife and a mother quite young, but I think she also has a lot of, she's got a lot of unfulfilled dreams of her own that she pushes on her children. And she was a really fun character to write. I have a great affection for Gertie, and I think in some ways she's this kind of archetypal Jewish mother, but I also wanted to make sure that she has her own selfhood.
This is, as you say, a Jewish family, and is it safe to say that Saul really is the only member of this family who is truly devout?
Yeah, I think you're right. And it is kind of funny how it works out like that. One thing that I wanted to explore in the book is how certain members of the family want to be believers more than they are actually believers. I think you see that particularly with Gertie and with Daniel. And there's a line in the book where Daniel says to his mother, who has kind of affected more of a faithfulness after the loss of her husband, you don't believe in God, you just want to. And that is something that I find to be true in my own life. I'm somebody who longs for that kind of solace and community, but I can't quite get myself there. And so that sort of longing mixed with a lack of true faith is something that I wanted to look at in these characters.
Is there also something that you wanted to look at of a betrayal to the religion of knowing the date of your death?
Yeah, I mean, there's something very pagan and very illicit about seeking that knowledge. You know, it goes back to the Garden of Eden and the eating of the apple. You know, how much should we seek to know and how much should we let that be? Whether you're saying, I'll put it in the hands of God, or whether you're not a believer, but saying, you know, I shouldn't have control of everything. I shouldn't try to have control of everything. The state of human being is one in which we don't have total control. So I do think that there's this element of the serpent in there, and whether knowledge is empowering or whether it's misleading.
Let us speak for a few moments about the Romani communities and what you found out about these communities and their practice of fortune-telling in this country.
Well, I tried to do a lot of research about each of the groups that I write about, if they're not ones that I'm a part of, whether it was gay men in the early 80s or whether it was the Rom. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a group that originated in India and then moved through the world in search of a place where they could settle. And then as a result, they've really settled everywhere. They were persecuted during the Holocaust and moved into other parts of Europe and then into the United States. And traditionally, they often live in poverty, not always. You know, they're underserved, and they're quite I think because of the persecution that they've gone through, they're very insular. So they have their own language. They are kind of cautious often of outsiders. But the fortune-telling practice is one that has been passed down through generations. And so I tried to learn a great deal about that and about their language and to honor that without slipping into stereotypes.
Let us talk about slipping into stereotypes for a moment. I wrote two things in the margins of the book, the things that struck me in the reading that I wanted to ask you about, and they are, one is about if there was a curiosity on your part about birth order, if that entered into is of a character being a typical older sister, or what it's like to be the youngest.
You know, I didn't do research specifically into birth order, but I do think that there are certain qualities that the siblings have because of their order, particularly, you know, the older two being more prone to responsibility and the younger two feeling a bit freer. I think that was probably more subconscious than intentional. I myself happen to be an oldest, and so I think that probably some of my psychology came into the older two siblings. And then thinking about how the expectations that had already been placed on them freed up a little bit for Simon and Clara, although Simon does have the weight of a great expectation on his shoulders in terms of this supposition that he'll continue on with the family business. And that's something that he has to shake off to great consequences.
The other thing I jotted down, and I'm just curious as to how I know how I came away feeling as a reader, but I'm curious as to you as the writer, as to whether you see this family as a close family.
Yes and no. Like a lot of families, I think they move in and out of closeness. They're close in some moments, they're not in others, and those moments may be minutes apart. Some of the siblings are closer than others. They each have a different relationship with their parents. So I see them as a family that is, you know, hopefully, or maybe not hopefully, given that they go through some really difficult estrangements, but I hope that people will see elements of themselves and in their families in the Golds. I think that they want to be close, and they struggle with the things that we all struggle with as human beings, which are resentments and frustrations and responsibility and blame and guilt. Families are such complicated ecosystems.
Indeed. And also just the geography versus the emotional closeness.
Yeah, they do spread across the country. The novel, as you say, begins on the Lower East Side in New York, and some of the siblings go to California. Clara winds up in Las Vegas. Daniel stays in upstate New York. So, there are certainly some families that stay in the same community and are very tight-knit in that way. My own family is spread out across the country, and so I think that probably influenced what I did with the Golds.
When you look at the Golds as a family, and ultimately that question that we started off asking about knowing the date of the death, do you then know how this is going to end at the very beginning? Did you know how you were going to pull it all together?
I knew how I wanted each section to end. I'm trying not to give any spoilers. I knew that I wanted the first three sections to end this is hard to do.
That's why I left it up to you. Yes.
Should I say kind of spoiler alert?
You don't have to. No, you can just say it. Basically, the question is, did you have it planned out? Did you know,
right.
Given that question of, if you knew the date that you died, did you have all the answers going into writing the novel?
I have some of the answers when I start working on a book. I generally have some sense of the idea of the ending, both the ending of the book and then the ending of each section, since this book is told in four sections, one for each sibling. But I also try to leave room for discovery along the way. I have always subscribed to this idea that E.L. Doctorow put forth, that when you're writing a novel, you can only see as far as the headlights show you, but you can make the whole trip that way. So I can kind of see ahead to the next scene, and then I can see ahead to the next scene. And at the same time, I have this North Star of, okay, here's where I want to get to at the end of it all. And then I try to let myself play.
And that's the fun part, right?
Yeah, that's the fun part. It's interesting. For somebody who really struggles with uncertainty, I find that fiction is the rare place where I let myself embrace it. So my therapist can do what she will with that.
But there's also the writing of the book, and then there's the thinking of the book, the thinking, the process of thinking it through.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing for me that when I'm working on a book and it's in my head, it's kind of constantly there. It's sort of another parallel world that I can go to. And there are moments in the writing of this book where something hit me once in the middle of the night, as cliche as that sounds, that really changed the course of the book. And so have this idea that I tell my subconscious, like a dog, I'm like, okay, go get it. And it can kind of be doing its work behind the scenes.
The last novel, the first novel that you wrote was The Anatomy of Dreams. How do you see this as a progression?
Well, I think that they both are novels that look at this idea of knowledge. How much should we know about ourselves and our lives, and how much should we simply live them and embrace not knowing? My first book followed a trio of dream researchers who are looking into the subconscious. So I can see, looking at both of them, where my obsessions lie. But I also think that the first book was much more internal. It was it was a first person. It's a little bit more claustrophobic in that sense. And with this second book, I wanted to write a book that was more of the times and of this world and of this country. And so I did more in terms of incorporating history, politics, and I did that intentionally because I wanted to write a book that felt like it had more of an inclusive and diverse scope so that it reflects the country that we live in.
Well, the name of the novel is The Immortalist. The book is published by Putnam. Chloe Benjamin, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so much for your wonderful close read. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Immortalists, published by Putnam. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.